AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
Life in our modern age comes at you pretty fast, which makes our time away especially valuable. When I take time to relax, I like to get far from my everyday life, immerse myself in natural beauty, and have unique experiences. But you don't have to leave the U.S. to experience tropical rainforests and islands filled with adventure, warm culture, and national treasures. Visit Puerto Rico, an island with a vibrant spirit that will sweep you away. Because when you visit, you don't become part of the island, it becomes part of you. In Puerto Rico, you can forget where you came from and embrace where you are. Puerto Rico, where visits end, but stories last forever. No passport required for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more and plan your trip at discoverpuertorico.com.
This episode of Stuff You Should Know is sponsored by Squarespace. Whether you need a landing page, a beautiful gallery, a professional blog, or an online store, it's all possible with the Squarespace website. Go to squarespace.com and set your website apart.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark, and there's Charles W. Chuck Bryant. This is Stuff You Should Know, the podcast, not the least of which is membered by Jerry.
Boy, that was exciting.
I have a bad cold.
Yeah.
My brain's not functioning quite right.
Yeah, but this is not the old days where you have the 6 weeks of cold.
Right.
Hopefully this will be just a couple of episodes.
That's right.
Bear with us.
Yeah, bear.
But to make up for it, I have all my teeth, finally.
Right. It's just this constant pendulum.
That's right.
It swings from one of us to the other.
Got all toothed up yesterday.
Feeling good?
The 8 months is over.
Like, click your teeth together for everybody.
I'm afraid to.
Oh, okay. Are you like, they're precious?
Yeah, I got to treat them very carefully. And I got fitted for a bite guard, so when I grind my teeth at night, this doesn't keep happening.
Yeah.
So things are looking good.
Yeah.
Everything's coming up, Chuck.
That's funny. Yumi has a bite guard, too, from grinding her teeth.
Yeah.
So two of the most significant people in my life...
Grind their teeth.
Both grind their teeth.
Does she bite her fingernails?
But I don't.
Does she bite her fingernails?
No, she doesn't. No.
Yeah, I take out my stresses on my body.
Yeah, those are short nails. Do they hurt? Do they just ache?
No.
Because sometimes
If I overdo it, they do.
When I cut my nails and I file them a little too short,
yeah,
they just ache for a day or so afterward.
Yeah.
Ugh.
It's a habit. I've always done it.
Yeah. Like since you can remember?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wore that bitter polish for a while when I was a kid to try and stop.
Oh, yeah.
And I just chewed right through it.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, it's so bitter. Still must bite.
But I kind of like it in a weird way.
Yeah.
The part of me that hates myself loves that taste.
It's so weird.
Well, Chuck, let's talk about another habit.
Okay.
A habit that humans have had for a very long time. And that is the habit of using animals as models for humans, as stand-ins for humans, when we want to test new things, find out new things about ourselves.
Yeah, like, will this kill me? Let's put it on an animal.
Right. Does the heart or the lungs actually pump blood around the body? Let's cut a dog open and find out.
Yeah.
We've been doing it for a very long time.
Yeah, and this article came with its own intro story, which was pretty interesting, I thought.
Yeah, we haven't done one of those in a long time. That used to be like a standard aspect of this.
Yeah, now we just babble.
Yeah, we just share what's going on in our lives, our days.
Pretty much.
Sorry, everybody. It must be a real letdown now that I think about it.
Should we do this, though?
Sure.
All right. Well, let's go back in time, back to 1937. And there was a pharma company called S.E. Massengill out of Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And they had a great, I almost want to say wonder drug that was an antibiotic that worked really well in its powdered form. And people started clamoring and said, we love this stuff, but it sure would be great if we could put it as a drop under my tongue instead.
Right. I like liquids. I'm not big on powders.
Sure.
Like that weirdo Richard Petty who just takes Goody's powder.
That's me. I love that. Dude, that's my go-to.
Yeah.
It's got caffeine. That's what helps.
Yeah, for migraines, too.
Oh, really?
Caffeine's a big one.
Yeah, Emily can't do them, but it's my...
I couldn't either.
It's my hangover cure.
I see.
Did I say that out loud?
You did.
Yeah. It works wonders.
I thought Bloody Marys were your hangover cure.
No, I'm not a hair of the dogger.
That's what it was invented for, you know.
Yeah.
All right, well, I'm getting us off track. I apologize.
So they decided we need a liquid form of this. What was the name of the drug?
Sulfanil. Man, I just had it. Sulfanilamide.
Yes.
Or sulfanilamide. I think sulfanilamide.
Okay.
That's how I would say it if I were a 1937 Tennessean.
Well, they had a chemist named Harold Cole Watkins who went to the lab and said, all right, let's dissolve this stuff in something called diethylene glycol.
Diethylene. That one I know.
Worked pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
So they added a little raspberry flavoring
mm-hmm.
to make it palatable, and they said, smells pretty good, tastes pretty good, looks pretty good, let's sell it.
Yeah, and they did. They sold a bunch of it. In just like one month after mixing up a batch of the stuff, they had 633 shipments all over the country.
Yes.
Because there was a huge demand for this. I mean, like, sulfanilamide was already an established drug. The idea of it being in some sort of palatable form,
yeah,
that was gangbusters.
Yeah, raspberry liquid.
Everybody had syphilis that they needed to take care of back then, and this kind of thing would help.
That's right.
And if it could be a pleasant experience, well, then great. And then that was September when they made their first shipment, right?
Yes.
By October, middle of October, October 11th to be specific, a group of doctors in Tulsa contacted the AMA, the American Medical Association, and said, we think there's something really wrong with this new Massengill product, which they called sulfanilamide elixir.
Yeah.
Or elixir of sulfanilamide. We think it's killing people, actually, and killing them in one of the worst ways imaginable.
Yeah, it wasn't a just go sleepy time now. It was a pretty bad death.
Right. You're writhing in agony. You're probably puking your guts up. You're dying from being poisoned.
Yeah. So the AMA got a hold of some stuff and they said, you know what? The actual drug is fine, but this, the solution we've mixed it with is the culprit. It is pure poison.
Yeah.
Who knew?
Nobody knew. And the reason why no one knew is because Massengill and Cole Watkins, or Harold Cole Watkins, and his group of chemists were not obligated to test this stuff out.
Yeah, well, people knew, though, that was the one frustrating thing, is mm-hmm. there were studies out that said this stuff was poison.
Right.
And I guess they just didn't read them.
Right, they didn't research the literature, which is a big deal.
Sure.
But they also didn't test it out on human or animal ahead of time.
Yeah.
And they just looked at the appearance, the smell, a little bit of the taste.
Yeah.
But no one took a full dose of this, apparently.
Yeah.
And people died. I think 100 people died in 15 states in about a month or so before they could get the shipments back. I think the FDA, the barely born FDA, this is one of its first actions, was going and getting this stuff.
Yeah, and the president of the company said, we haven't broken any laws because I guess there weren't laws on the books at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the head chemist very sadly killed himself because of this.
Yeah.
Like the story goes from bad to worse.
Right.
And,
Which, that was pretty Japanese of him.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Did we do a full episode on that?
On suicide?
On, Harikari, but it had another name too, right?
Seppuku.
Yeah. Didn't we do that or did we just mention it?
I'm sure we just mentioned it.
Okay.
I think in the, Japanese stragglers and probably the samurai.
Yeah.
And the revenge one.
Yeah. Boy. It's hard to keep track these days, isn't it?
Yeah, oh, yeah. It really, really is.
So this led to, in 1938, Congress in the U.S. Enacted the FDA Cosmetic Act, which said that, you know what, you need to test these drugs on animals, and that therein sort of started, at least in the U.S., the official decree that you can and should do this.
Right.
But it had been going on a long time before that.
Right.
Our buddy Galen, who we've talked about before.
Well, even further back than Galen, if you look at the Greeks, at least as far back as about 500 BC, the ancient Greeks were using animals for testing, poking around, figuring out how the human body works. And there was this idea that there was an analogy between all animals, that humans shared like a lot of the same physiology of all animals. And there was a great disagreement among the Greeks in particular about whether that was true. But it didn't stop guys like Aristotle and
Erasistratus?
Yeah, and Hippocrates as well from basically poking around inside live animals, which is where the term for animal testing came from. The other term is vivisection.
Right.
Vivisection is cutting something open while it's still alive.
Yeah, specifically an animal, right? Or is that...
No, you can vivisect humans.
Oh, can you?
Yeah. Because dissection occurs after death.
Right.
Vivisection is like cutting open. I think technically surgery would be, but the idea behind vivisection is that this is just for experimentation. Usually.
Gotcha. Not like, let me heal that organ right there.
Right. Which, by the way, go back and listen to our human experimentation episode. That was a great one.
I remember that one. So flash forward a bit to 2nd century Rome, where our friend Galen, who we just talked about him in a podcast.
Our live stuff in UK and Ireland.
That's right. Which hopefully people will hear soon.
Yes.
He was a medical specialist, and he said, you know what? I'm going to do a demonstration in the public. I'm going to rent a hall.
Watch this.
I'm going to get this pig.
Watch this pig.
And I'm going to prove that we are all a bundle of nerves by snipping certain nerves of this pig.
Hmm.
You want to see him not squeal anymore?
Yep.
Watch me snip this nerve.
Right.
And it was all planned, and this philosopher, a pretty popular guy.
He had punch and cookies out. He was really excited for this day.
A philosopher that was in attendance named Alexander Damascenus. Yeah? Damascenus?
One of those two.
He said, you know what? This is BS. Doesn't prove a thing. And in fact, none of these demonstrations prove anything. Because that's a pig and we're humans. Why are you bothering?
Right. And apparently the Romans had adopted from the Greeks the idea that empirical evidence didn't really prove anything.
Yeah, they had an uphill battle.
If you saw something... It doesn't mean it was true.
Right.
Which is a weird philosophy. I'd like to understand a little more. I'm sure there's a lot more to it than that.
Sure.
But that's just like such a completely, radically different paradigm from what we have now. The paradigm of science where seeing is indeed believing, that it requires empirical evidence. It used to be the opposite.
Yeah.
And that was Alexander's big objection. Like, hey, man, you can cut that pig's nerve all day long. And sure, I saw it, and sure, it had that effect, but it doesn't prove anything.
Right.
And Galen was like, I hate you. I hate that idea. I hate Aristotle.
Yeah, I'm leaving.
Because Aristotle was apparently somebody who said, I've poked around in a pig or two in my time, and I've concluded that the heart and not the brain is the center. This idea that a nerve connected to the brain could control anything is hogwash, if you'll forgive the pun.
Yeah, Aristotle was just a big dummy.
The dumbest of them all.
So Galen did, in fact, say, I'm leaving. He said, I'm taking my medical bag and I'm going home. And then everyone there was like, Bo, I really want to see this pig get cut apart.
Come on.
Please don't leave. So he said, okay, you guys, I'll do it.
You twisted my arm.
Came back in, performed the experiment and the demonstration. And this was one of the first recorded examples of experimenting on animals for science.
Yeah.
So the ball was rolling.
Yeah, and I don't know if Galen hadn't done it first, and he obviously hadn't done it first because he came a few hundred years after Aristotle, who had done that. But if Aristotle hadn't done it, eventually somebody who was curious enough would have grabbed a dog or a chicken or something and just cut it open and started looking at what was inside.
Yeah.
You know?
For sure.
Like, it would have happened, but these are the people who are recorded doing it first.
Go forward in time a bit to the late 19th century, and there was a microbiologist from Germany, Robert Koch.
Koch?
And he got some anthrax. He got some blood from cows killed by anthrax.
Right.
Started looking at it under a microscope and said, you know what? Something in there looks funny to me. That might be the anthrax. So let me take that and put it in a mouse and see what happens. The mouse died, and he said, I'm onto something here.
I'm pretty sure that was the anthrax.
Yep.
It
was a big deal.
It was a big deal. Again, using an animal to experiment in order to further human understanding and protect human health and life.
That's right.
Those are the biggies that people have used animals for.
Yeah, and that was actual, like, medically let me try and cure a disease.
Yeah, not like the early guys, like, what does this do? What happens if I sever this?
Yeah, but it
do you
it
like
went
my,
on.
My ancient Greek impression?
Yeah. The point I was trying to make, I guess, was later on in the 1950s, people started, mm-hmm. and notably this Russian Dmitry Belyev, started using research on animals, not necessarily for curing diseases, but to study behavior.
Right.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, we talked about them in our animal domestication episode.
Yeah, so what he had the great idea for these cute little silver foxes. He's like, I might like one of those as a pet.
Sure. I have a niece who would love one of those.
Man, have you seen those fox videos?
Yeah, where they cry and walk around crying.
Well,
or calling or whatever.
Yeah, and they shake their little tail when you scratch their belly. And
I don't know if I've seen that one.
Oh, it's very cute. They make sort of like a little purring, little chirpy purr and wiggle their tail and wag their tail. And it's just like, oh, man, you're the perfect combination of dog and cat.
Yeah, foxes are pretty cute.
Yeah.
So that's why we wanted to tame them.
Well, that's exactly what he did, too. And he thought, I know that domestication usually takes many, many, many years, but let me see if I can do it in like 20, 25 years.
Right. And Chuck, speaking of behavioral studies, one of the most famous of all using animals was Pavlov's dogs. And I was researching it, and I had no idea. Pavlov didn't just, like, ring a bell for his dogs to make them salivate.
Right.
He surgically altered his dogs. He went and got their salivary glands and put them on the outside of their faces
what?
So that he could collect saliva samples more easily.
Wow.
And he created, remember that cow in Athens that had a porthole in it?
Yep.
Same thing for the dogs.
Wow.
So that he could collect gastric juices, digestive juices for samples as well.
So what you're saying is that he was a crazy madman.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so.
Wow.
So I think the larger point here is that humans have been just grabbing animals or even breeding animals for the sole purpose of using them to understand things a little more, right?
Yes.
Whether it be cutting them open to see how anatomy works, to using them as for medical experiments to determine that anthrax is actually bloodborne and can kill you.
Yeah.
To behavioral studies, right?
Yeah. And we should point out that at work, he was able to weed out, and by weed out, I mean cull, and by cull, we mean kill.
And by kill, we mean probably break their necks.
You think?
Yeah, I think that's one of the big problems with this talking about this stuff is so many euphemisms are used.
Yeah.
Like you just demonstrated.
Yeah. So what he did was he was able to weed out the foxes that weren't as tame, and eventually he ended up with a fox that was, by all accounts, domesticated.
Yeah.
A nice little pet.
It said, Dmitry, I love you. And it's not just animals that are cute that we can tame. Animals on what most people would say are roughly the lower end of the spectrum as far as life is concerned are very frequently used, like nematodes, fruit flies.
Sure.
They come into use largely because they have some similar processes. Like if you're studying a very ancient process,
right,
or a very ancient part of the body, like insulin regulation,
uh-huh.
You're going to find it throughout the animal kingdom. It's going to be pretty widespread.
Okay.
So the idea is if you can track insulin regulation in a fruit fly, you could conceivably extrapolate those findings onto a human.
Right.
And a human's insulin regulation. And the advantage of a fruit fly or a nematode is that they're really easy to breed.
Sure.
And they reproduce very quickly.
Yeah, there's a lot of them.
So if you're like Dmitry Belyev and you're studying foxes,
yeah,
it took him 25 years to go through 20 generations.
Yeah.
It would take you roughly a month, I would guess, to go through about 20 generations of fruit flies. So therefore, you can track mutations much more quickly.
Sure.
Much more inexpensively. So fruit flies, nematodes, other, again, lesser life forms have been used extensively in medical testing as well. And they count. They qualify. It's a live organism that's being used for experimentation purposes.
Yeah, and it kind of depends on what you're trying, what your aim is, what your goal is, to what animal you do use, because you can't just use any animal for anything. And here's a fun fact. I did not know that the armadillo is an animal that can actually get Hansen's disease, a.k.a. leprosy.
We knew that. We talked about it in the leprosy episode.
I don't remember mentioning the armadillo.
I am scared to death of armadillos now because of that.
Really?
Oh, yeah. When I see it, I just look at them like leprosy.
You don't hug them any longer?
No. No, and like you'll see them on the side of the road, you know, hit by a car or something like that.
Yeah, Texas.
I always double check. Well, here in Georgia, too.
Yeah, a little bit.
I always check to make sure that my air recirculator is on when I pass them by, that like the leprosy didn't waft into my car as I drove past the roadkill.
Wow.
That I was damaged by the leprosy episode.
Well, they actually have the perfect body temperature to allow study on vaccines for leprosy.
And speaking of, by the way, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I just found out last night that koalas carry chlamydia.
Really?
And transmit it sexually and can die from it.
Oh, man.
Yeah, and are actually partially endangered in some ways because they have chlamydia.
Hmm. Yeah. Think about that next time you want a hug from that cute little critter.
Right.
You know?
Oh, well, they'll tear your face off, too.
Should we take a little break here?
Yeah.
All right. Let's take a break, and we're going to come back and talk more about the different animals used and why.
All right, game off. Let's pause here to talk more about Monopoly Go. Because in Monopoly Go, you can team up with your friends for timed tournaments where you work together to build up each other's boards. It's very nice.
That's right. And the more you win together, the more awesome prizes you unlock. And there's so much to get. I'm talking about unique stickers that you can trade with friends to complete albums for big prizes, cool new playing pieces to travel the boards with, or hilarious emojis for taunting friends when you smash their buildings or heist their vaults.
Plus, Monopoly Go feels new and exciting every day with constantly changing tournaments and challenges, like digging for treasure or a robot pachinko machine. And there's always new timed events that help you win big, like massive multipliers for everything you win or rent frenzies.
That's right. There's always something fun to discover in Monopoly Go. So get off the bench and go download it now for free on Google Play or the App Store. Game on.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI and revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Chuck, before we get back to it, I want to say this is this episode and the other one that's coming out Thursday.
Oh, yeah, there's a suite.
Yeah, and they're kind of done in conjunction with these guys, Joe and Tim, who run a site called PrimerStories.com, and they do seasons. They're like animators, web dudes.
Uh-huh.
And it shows. They know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And they've basically taken, they'll take essays. I wrote an essay. Then they take it and they break it up into chunks and they animate it, right? So as you're going, scrolling down, you're reading, but you're also experiencing, the art, the animation that really kind of brings out the ideas of each one. It's a really, really neat site. They contacted us after our San Francisco show last year.
Right.
Or no, early this year. And they said, hey, do you want to do one of these? And I went and looked, and I was amazed.
Yeah.
And said, yes, I totally do. So you can go check out the essay I wrote at primerstories.com/SYSK.
And that one is the one we're releasing after this one, correct?
Well, it ties into both. It's kind of this essay about humans changing attitude toward animal rights.
Yeah.
But it was fun to do, and they're cool. They're cool dudes for sure, and I like what they're doing. This is their fourth season.
Nice.
Fourth season.
Nice plug. Nice work.
Thanks.
All right, so we were talking about using different animals and how if it's, you know, a fruit fly or a nematode, people don't get their hackles up too much.
No, it's true.
If it is a rat or a mouse, people start getting their hackles up a little more.
Yeah.
And mice are very famously used a lot. 90% of our genes overlap with this mouse, specifically this one. Which is it?
Moose or muse genus mice? Mises genus mice?
So that's the one that they use most often that has the 90% overlap. And their cell structure and organ organization are basically the same as ours. So they do a lot of testing with these mice as a result. Everything from, you know, disease and stuff to genetics to behavioral, they kind of run the gamut.
Right, for mice?
Yeah.
For sure. And from that point up, they tend to, I think, run the gamut. Some are a little more specific than others, like beagles, apparently.
Yeah.
Really come in handy when you're testing prostate cancer. Or
muscular dystrophy, both.
Yeah. Because they can contract those or develop those. So they make great animal models.
Yeah, these cats, because their sight and their hearing and their balance.
I have to ask, how are you feeling right now?
About this episode?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what do you mean?
Like about the topic.
Because
you're holding it together really well.
You mean I'm not crying yet?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've checked my emotions out of this one.
Okay.
I think this two-part suite will get points across.
Sure.
I'm just relying on that. I'll get weepy later tonight.
Do you remember The Secret of NIMH?
Yeah, sure.
I had forgotten what the secret was, or I don't think it ever dawned on me what the secret really was, and I went back and was reading about the...
Those were mice, right?
They were rats.
Rats, yeah.
And The Secret of NIMH, well, we probably shouldn't say.
Would that be a spoiler?
Yeah, I think so. It's like the spoiler. Like, that's in the title.
What if The Secret of NIMH was that Bruce Willis in The Sixth Sense was dead all along?
Mm. You know what I think was an even...
Oh, wait, is that a spoiler?
Yeah, I think it was. It was years ago, at least. If you haven't seen The Sixth Sense by now, TS for you.
Save your email.
Go see The Others, though. A lot of people haven't seen The Others.
Which
saw
that?
The Sixth Sense. The one with Nicole Kidman and
kids. That was good.
Man, that was great.
Very atmospheric, moody film.
That one and The Orphanage.
Yeah, another good one.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Agreed.
I think The Orphanage is maybe even the better of the two.
Oh, yeah?
Yep.
So monkeys, primates, well, non-human primates, we should say.
Nice.
Specifically, the macaque monkey is used a lot because there's a lot of them, and they're widely distributed and have a robust population. So... You know, they've made a lot of advances into neuroscience thanks to the macaque monkey.
And then there's some animals that'll just do because they contain flesh, like pigs and goats.
Right.
Are used a lot in what's called live tissue trauma training, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's used to train battlefield medics in the military.
Yeah.
And the Coast Guard, apparently. And the animal's anesthetized deeply to, like, surgical plane levels and shot or blown up or just weird stuff's done to it to simulate a battlefield trauma.
Wow.
So that a medic can do what it's called, live tissue trauma training.
So they can save a life on the battlefield.
Yeah, but then they euthanize they kill the animal afterward.
Sure,
but, yes, on the battlefield. That's the whole point.
They're
saying there's no substitute for that.
Well, which is sort of scientists and doctors say. Well, we'll get into all that.
Okay.
One thing we should mention, though, is that if you look for labels that say this was not tested on animals, it's sort of like the whole free-range chicken myth. It's not exactly what you think it is.
Right. Well, free-range chickens, doesn't it have to have like a porch attached to the structure? And they don't even have to have access to it necessarily?
You just have to have the door open so they can leave if they want.
I got you.
But you have people have images, I think, of these chickens running around the fields.
The idyllic countryside.
Yeah, but they don't. They're in the barn where the food is, and they kind of don't leave. But the door's there, so they're technically free-range. Unless something's changed. When I worked in the chicken industry, that sad year or whatever it was.
I would guess absolutely nothing's changed.
Probably so. But if you look for labels that say cruelty-free or not tested on animals, it may not mean what you think because technically there's no oversight on a label like that. And it could mean that we did not, in the final product of this cosmetic, test it on animals. We didn't test this rouge, but all the raw ingredients that went into this from our suppliers were tested on animals.
Right. Or back in the 60s or 70s, they tested these same ingredients on animals, and there's no need for us to test them again. So now we can say, not tested on animals, even though...
Lately.
These things were tested on animals years back.
Yeah.
And actually, China has changed things recently as the West was getting further and further away. I think the EU banned imports of anything that had been tested on animals, cosmetics-wise.
Oh, wow.
And China has gone the opposite direction. It is mandated that anything imported into China, cosmetics-wise, must have been tested on animals. So it kind of reset things here in the West because there's a lot of Western companies like,
yeah,
I want in on that Chinese market. And China's saying, well, you got to test your, like, the whole thing on animals before it comes in here.
Right. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the deal. Over the 20th century, we've made a lot of medical advances. Life expectancy, this is kind of a neat stat,
yeah,
has gone up about 3 months per year in the 20th century, largely due to stuff like this, testing for disease.
Well, yeah, people who are advocates of animal testing say that would not have happened, maybe at all, had we not used animals.
That's right.
And life expectancy was extended 3 months a year from, I think, like 1840 to 2006 or something like that.
That's nuts.
Every year.
Yeah.
And that was advanced by finding things like antibiotics and vaccines and all of the things that not just extend the human life, but make the extended years more enjoyable as well,
right,
more healthy. And that's a huge rallying cry for people who point to animal testing and say this is necessary and has,
right,
to continue. And actually, there was a 2011 poll of biomedical researchers by Nature, which is no slouch of a scientific journal, and they found that 90% agreed with the sentence, use of animals in research is essential.
Right.
That's 2011. So
yeah,
that sentiment isn't going anywhere.
No, I think that's probably pretty much accurate today. On the other side of the coin, you have animal rights activists, and even if you're not an activist, just your average Joe on the street or Jane might say, you know what, this is unethical, it does a lot of harm, it's wasteful, and there are better ways to do it. And in fact, some people say it's not even doing the job that it should be doing. For instance, they can cure cancer in mice, and we have been able to do this for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Can't cure it in humans. Of the 85 HIV/AIDS vaccines that were tested successfully on primates,
mm-hmm,
they don't work on humans.
And one of them may have even made humans more susceptible,
yeah,
to it.
Yeah, so it's there's two very strong sides to this argument. The FDA has said that 9/10 of all drugs in development don't work in humans after they worked in animals because you just can't tell.
Right, and actually, I looked that up. It's a little bit of a fallacy. It's more like 94%.
Oh, wow.
Fail in clinical trials, but that's all preclinical trials. So not just animal testing, but also non-animal testing.
Yeah.
Where it passed the first stages when it made it to clinical trials, 94% of all drugs failed to work or actually harmed humans. There's another side of the coin, though, too, Chuck.
How many sides are on this coin?
It's like one of those 100-sided die that you see in D&D but never know how to use.
Yeah.
There are probably a lot of drugs out there that harmed animals and were shelved right then, didn't make it into clinical trials because the animals were harmed, that may not have harmed humans and could have cured things.
Interesting.
So there's people saying, no, we need to be testing on humans because we're using this for humans.
Right.
That's what some protesters against animal testing would say. And then another thing that I saw is that you tend to think like, okay, well, it's advancing science, so I can't really get in the way of that.
Right.
But there are one of the critiques of that argument is not all the science is good that's being done. And like a lot of animal lives, if you agree that animal lives are valuable, but that using an animal life to advance scientific understanding to protect human health and life is worthy, it's a worthy use of an animal, then that you would also probably agree with the idea that wasting the animal's life in scientific testing is unforgivable, right?
Yeah.
So there was this survey in 2009, PLOS-1, Proceedings of the Library of Science 1, the journal, of 271 animal studies that found that 41% failed to even state a hypothesis or objective to the test.
Wow.
30% failed to describe the statistic methods used in the study. 87% didn't randomize. 86% didn't use blinding. And those are basic scientific efforts that you have to make in any experiment, right? Those are very basic. Which means that those things were wasted, which means those animals' lives were wasted. And the suggestion is that a lot of publicly funded science is just not very good science, and it's wasting the lives of the animals involved.
Well, that's sad. I'm starting to get emotional.
Okay.
All right, let's take a break then, and we'll come back and talk a little bit about our old buddy, Charles D. Chuck D. Darwin.
All right, game off. Let's pause here to talk more about Monopoly Go. Because in Monopoly Go, you can team up with your friends for timed tournaments where you work together to build up each other's boards. It's very nice.
That's right. And the more you win together, the more awesome prizes you unlock. And there's so much to get. I'm talking about unique stickers that you can trade with friends to complete albums for big prizes, cool new playing pieces to travel the boards with, or hilarious emojis for taunting friends when you smash their buildings or heist their vaults.
Plus, Monopoly Go feels new and exciting every day with constantly changing tournaments and challenges, like digging for treasure or a robot pachinko machine. And there's always new timed events that help you win big, like massive multipliers for everything you win or rent frenzies.
That's right. There's always something fun to discover in Monopoly Go. So get off the bench and go download it now for free on Google Play or the App Store. Game on.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI and revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, so I teased everybody with Charles Darwin.
Oh, is that who you're talking about?
Which is what I do every Halloween. I dress up as Charles Darwin and tease the local teens.
Oh, what are you going to dress up as for our show in D.C.? On October 29th.
I don't know, but I'm glad you mentioned that because we're doing a show at the Lincoln Theater and we're turning it into a Halloween ball.
It's a Halloween bash, not even a ball.
Yeah.
It's a rung above the ball.
Including a reading of a Halloween story like we do just for their ears only.
Yeah, plus we'll be dressed up. Yes. We're encouraging everyone who comes to be dressed up.
Maybe I'll go as Charles Darwin.
And as far as I know, it's an all-ages show. But it could get spooky, and our shows do get a little blue. So just FYI, you've been warned.
So Charles Darwin, who I may dress up as.
I'm pretty sure I know what I'm going as. I'd rather not reveal it the time.
He was kind of in on this game a long time ago. And he loved animals, but he also wanted to study animals. But he also wanted to treat them humanely while he studied animals.
sounds like Charles Darwin kind of approach.
Yes. So there was in 1874, there was, like, people were actually starting to get in trouble for some of these things. In 1874, these scientists were actually put on trial for torturing dogs because they wanted to see how absinthe and alcohol affected their nervous system. So they cut them open and exposed them to these liquids.
They just doused them in is what I'm taking from it.
I have no idea. I guess so. They were actually acquitted, but it sort of brought things into the in the front of everyone's minds. And Darwin, people were saying, let's not do this at all. And Darwin stepped in and said, he was a little more moderate and said, you know what, let's craft a bill here in the United Kingdom where you can do this, but do it humanely. And that resulted in the Cruelty to Animals Act of 1876.
Yeah.
It was pretty great. It was advancement.
It was, but the UK actually has long led the way in the West for animal rights. Even before that, as we'll see, they were trying to protect animals, as we'll see in the next episode.
That's right. And then a little later in 1954, the University's Federation of Animal Welfare said, let's get these two dudes, a zoologist and a microbiologist, Russell and Birch, and just do a lot of research, guys, and come back with some findings that we can use. And boy, did they.
Yeah, they were like, there's a lot better that we can do in protecting animals. They, scientists are typically dumb and can only remember things through alliteration. So these guys came up with the three R's.
Right.
Something that could be put on a PSA poster.
Yeah.
The three R's, I'm just teasing about the scientist thing, are replacement, reduction, and refinement, right?
Yes.
So your first goal is to find a replacement of the animal. Is there any alternative to the animal in this experiment?
Yeah, well, like a sentient animal with a worm, perhaps, instead of a mouse.
Right. Or, you know, if you can find a willing robot.
Right.
You know?
That fits the bill.
The second one's reduction. You want to reduce the number of animals used to the absolute minimum.
Yeah.
You don't want to have any spare orangutans hanging around. You want to know how many you're going to use, and those are the ones that you can kill.
Correct. And then finally, refine, which means, and this is, you know, sort of the opposite of what you were talking about with those awful stats that you said.
Right.
Like, let's refine this and at least get your technique down so well that the suffering is minimized to its bare minimum as well.
And the waste is reduced.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was 1959 that Russell and Birch released the three R's. This is 2009 that one study I cited was conducted.
That's 50
years later.
Yeah. So, PETA, you know, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, we've talked about them quite a bit on the show. They are down with the three R's, of course. But they say, you know what, that's not enough, though. We have a lot of studies that show that there are way better ways of doing things these days than using animals.
Yeah.
With the computer modeling that we have now and software and humans.
Yeah, and they've figured out techniques using stem cells to grow organs or organ cells or, like, say, skin cells in vitro. And then exposing them to the chemicals you want to test. And then not only will you have your reaction or non-reaction, you'll also have it with, like, a human cells.
Yeah.
So it's not like, oh, it messed this rabbit's face up pretty bad. Well, we'll just assume that it will mess up a human skin as well. No, this stuff really burned through that human skin tissue that we synthesized. So now we know for sure not to give it to humans.
Right.
There's also something called, because a big objection to that is, Well, that's just it's a group of skin cells in vitro that doesn't really replicate, you know, these really intricate interplays that make up organs and systems of organs.
Yeah.
And there's a company out called, I don't remember what they're called, but their invention is organ on a chip.
Oh, wow.
It's amazing, dude. I watched this video about it last night.
Like on a tortilla chip?
I wish. It's the only way it could be better is if you could eat it afterward. But it'd be pretty messed up if you did. So it's like a USB stick size module.
Uh-huh.
That's the word I'm going with. It's transparent. And say the lung on a chip has some branching stuff.
Uh-huh.
And inside there is a layer of lung cells.
Yeah.
And that replicate and simulate a human lung, right?
Okay.
So you have human lung cells growing in arranged in the way that they would in the human lung. And then this device allows you to pass air over the top and blood over the top and introduce bacteria and introduce white blood cells and study what they do. So you're replicating the function of a human lung on this little thing.
But it's all a simulation.
It is, but it's a real simulation.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
It's using real lung cells and they're functioning like a lung normally would.
Yeah.
Except you don't have to say here, inhale this. We'll just pass this antibiotic across the lung cells and it'll treat it like the human lung would.
Interesting.
It's amazing. And then yeah, if you could eat it afterward, eat the human lung cells with some guacamole, you'd be like, This is the circle of life is complete.
Well, that's sort of one of the big points, though, that PETA and a lot of organizations use is that we're so advanced now with our computer modeling and these simulations that they are better ways than, like, it's sort of archaic to experiment on an animal. Like, these are not only cruelty-free, but it's smarter and better.
Right.
That's the argument they make.
Yeah, and I mean, the statistics cut both ways. Like, if you look at PETA's stats, they're like animal models are predictive in this dismal range,
right,
for, you know, human outcomes. And then the people who are in favor of animal testing say, well, these computer models are actually the ones that have dismal results,
right?
So both sides, I guess it's just too new, maybe it's unproven.
Yeah,
but there does seem to be a movement afoot in biomedicine to replace as much as possible computer models animals with computer models.
Yeah. Some of the other things that animal rights groups lobby for are things like, well, how about you just do like CT scans or MRIs? You're not actually harming the animal.
Mm-hmm.
Or this thing called microdosing, where you actually give humans just very, very small doses of these medicines,
right,
that won't be enough to hurt them if things don't work out. But you could tell if it's going to be effective or not.
Yeah, it still produces that reaction on a molecular level. It's just not going to have a system-wide toxic effect on it.
Yeah,
that's
pretty amazing.
That's pretty neat.
Yeah.
There's some change, but at the same time, there's also some digging in on both sides as well. Like, for example, with that live tissue trauma training, there's a movement to replace any live animal with a dummy or a mannequin or something like that. And the people who are proponents of using animals in live tissue trauma training say, man, there's something that can happen to a battlefield medic during combat, and that's called freezing.
Uh-huh.
When they're presented with a human being with, you know, a major trauma,
right,
they can just sit there and freeze and freak out because this is the first time they've been exposed to it. One of the aspects of, you know, blowing the leg off of a pig is that this person's having to work on a pig. And yeah, it's a pig, but it's a live pig.
Right. It's not a Recessa Annie.
Right. Exactly. And maybe they made the person care for the pig for like a week first so that it has even more.
Oh,
of
wow.
It. Well, I just made that up, but you could see how that would be tough to replace. That's
sure.
A tough one to argue with.
Yeah.
But I think ultimately the question is raised, Chuck. And this is what we're going to address in the next episode is probably the largest question of all, and is, do humans have, or have humans ever had, the right to use animals for our own means?
Right.
And that's, we'll talk about that one on the next episode.
Boy, that's a nice cliffhanger.
I think so, too.
Well done.
Do we have listener mail this one?
Yeah, and you know what? Not only that, we have a two-part listener mail.
Awesome.
That has its own cliffhanger.
Man, all right. Well, let's get to it. So if you want to know more about animal testing, you can type that word in the search bar at howstuffworks.com, and it will bring up this excellent article. And since I said search bar, it's time for part one of listener mail.
That's right. This one was so robust. It's an unprecedented two-parter from Yvonne. Not Ivan, but Yvonne.
Will he grow up to be a good man?
I hope so. No, that's Levon.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the L's silent.
And those weren't the right words anyway, but it's adorable. All right, here we go. First off, guys, got to say, you're not only my favorite podcast, but you're also my 10-year-old son's favorite podcast. Listen to every episode at least twice. How about that? And my son's also a big fan of your TV show and the animated shorts. Boy,
poor
they're
kid.
In deep.
Wow.
However, my beautiful fiance is not. in fact, there have been times when I will be sitting next to her and she's reading a book and I'll have my headphones listening to the podcast so I don't disturb her, and I'll burst out laughing like a crazy person, in her words. This, quote, crazy, end quote, behavior of mine is directly related to listening to you two, so thanks for that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, one of the reasons I write is to call your attention. You said on the Sugar It Powers the Earth podcast in 2014, Chuck says, one day we're going to re-record a show and not realize it. We're going to hear about it. Well, you managed to do it. You probably heard from someone else by now, but you have covered the topic of customs twice.
Yep.
The most recent one in August 2016, and the previous one in September of 2010. Don't get me wrong, both were great. But I honestly think that both of you legitimately forgot. I was waiting for either of you to acknowledge it the second time, and that never came. And Yvonne, you are right on the money, pal.
Yeah, it's true.
Josh emailed me and said, hey, buddy, guess what? We've done this. It finally happened.
Yeah.
We released it. And at first I was like, shoot. But then I thought, you know what? We got a nice bit of trivia now.
Mm-hmm.
It was bound to happen, and now people have, it's almost like an Easter egg.
Right.
That listeners and fans can say, like, you know which one they did twice? If you're a true fan, you know.
You know, it's weird, though. At no point during the research and recording of the customs episode was I like, this sounds really familiar. Or, did we talk about this?
Nothing.
No point whatsoever.
Nope.
So that might make the first customs episode the least memorable episode we've ever done.
Perhaps. So part two you can look for in the second part of this suite coming out from Yvonne, wherein he made a list of all of our band names over the years.
Wow.
And he also made a list of your puns.
I am not punny. I take issue with that. I'll talk about it in the next episode.
Great. That's a great setup.
If you want to get in touch with us, like Levon.
Yvonne.
And what is his son's name? Did he say?
He didn't say, but
Yvonne and son?
Yeah.
They sound like a funeral home.
That's right.
You can tweet to us at SYSK Podcast or hang out with me at Josh Clark. You can hang out with us on Facebook at facebook.com/stuffyoushouldknow and check out Chuck at Charles W. Chuck Bryant and me at Super Josh Clark, both on Facebook. We're on Instagram. We're on social media that hasn't even been invented yet.
Yeah.
Plus, you can send us an email to stuffpodcast@howstuffworks.com. And as always, join us at our home on the web, the newly updated stuffyoushouldknow.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, if you haven't heard of Visible, well, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon as low as $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Use promo code STUFF20 to receive $20 off your first month for listening to this podcast. Switch now at Visible.com. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. The Visible monthly rate is $25 per month.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.